Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, Sunday, May 3rd, 2009, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on this lovely spring day. Today we're going to have as our guest someone who's been on the program before, an acclaimed journalist and one of the original and really outstanding media watchers of the past four decades. Our guest is going to be none other than Danny Schechter, the news dissector. He'll be talking about the state of the news media today, some of the big stories that he's been covering, his work and his long and distinguished career. It's going to be a wonderful hour, so stay tuned and join us. But before we go to Danny Schechter, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Wilson, North Carolina is a small city of 47,000, located 45 miles east of Raleigh. It grew up with the tobacco industry at the turn of the 20th century. And while tobacco remains, the boom years are in the past, and the city is looking ahead to the new information economy. Internet service for Wilson had been slow and unreliable. So in 2006, the city built a fiber optic ring that connected city facilities like City Hall, Parks and Recreation, and town offices to super-fast broadband. After requests from local businesses, the city council voted to expand the fiber network to the entire city. Brian Bowman is the public affairs manager for the city of Wilson.
We went to Time Warner and to Embark and said, we would love for you to build a fiber-to-the-premise network in Wilson. Embark said that they wanted to work with us to partner on that. It turned out it didn't work out because we couldn't meet that middle ground for both of us for it to work out. And Time Warner just said, no, we're not going to do that right now. So we said, okay, we'll do it ourselves.
Wilson's network, called Greenlight, is up and running, with connections up to 100 megabits per second, which makes it among the fastest services available in the country. The city offers a triple play package of TV, phone, and internet for $99 per month every month. That beats Time Warner Cable's package that has fewer channels, slower upload speeds, and costs 40% more at the start. After less than a year in business, Greenlight has already signed up more than 3,000 customers, and that apparently has made Time Warner Cable, Embark, and AT&T very nervous. They've backed a new bill in the North Carolina State Legislature that would ban the use of certain municipal funds to finance and maintain a broadband network and would cut off local communities from receiving money for broadband from the Federal American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
If this bill had been law when we started, Greenlight would not exist today. It simply sandbags the cities where it's not possible or practical to do it. That's the effect of the bill.
The bill's sponsors are clearly taking their marching orders from the cable and phone companies. Bowman describes a recent hearing.
You know who's in the room with you, and it is a handful of private sector providers who seem to be the ones who were talking in the hallways to the sponsors. And, you know, we saw a person from Time Warner, in fact, hand a note to one of the sponsors during the meeting, and the sponsor then spoke up. So all you know officially is who the sponsors are, but, you know, you can see what's happening in the room.
Bowman says that Wilson is one of those cities that doesn't have the population density that makes it attractive to private industry.
If profit was going to be the motive, we were going to be waiting potentially decades to get this critical service, which we believe our businesses need. And right now we're doing it ourselves. We're having good results. And this law would essentially keep other cities in North Carolina from being able to do the same thing.
And now, a special commentary about community radio by Media Minute's own Candace Clement.
Last week, more than 40 representatives from community radio stations and groups hoping to obtain broadcast licenses visited Washington, D.C. to tell their stories to Congress. In a series of visits to congressional offices, the Federal Communications Commission, and the White House, they urged action on the Local Community Radio Act, a bill that would put more low-power FM, or LPFM, radio stations on the air. Some of the visitors were from existing LPFM stations and came to D.C. to explain the wide array of benefits that local radio can bring. They included KPCNLP, an LPFM in Woodburn, Oregon, that broadcasts in four languages native to the indigenous communities of the local farm workers. Also there was WRFNLP, Radio Free Nashville, a station with nearly 100 local programmers broadcasting community news and local music, providing an antidote to the five clear channel stations dominating the local airwaves. Others came to talk about the radio stations their community wanted to start but can't get on the air until this legislation passes. The Chicago Independent Radio Project, or CHIRP, is pulling together everything needed to get their station on the air, right down to the drywall for its studio. And Detroit Summer, which organizes youth-led media arts projects, came to speak about the particular needs that cities face and how LPFMs can help them achieve their mission. Democratic Representative Mike Doyle of Pennsylvania, who introduced the legislation in the House with Republican Representative Lee Terry of Nebraska, stated at a policy briefing last Thursday that Rick Boucher, the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Communications Subcommittee, seemed inclined to move toward a hearing on the legislation soon, the crucial next step toward putting more LPFM stations on the air. To learn more about the Local Community Radio Act, visit PrometheusRadio.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, May 3rd, 2009. The last time our guest was on the show, which was about two and a half years ago, he talked about the subprime mortgage crisis and what the threat was to not only our financial system, but our entire economy. And I think it's fair to say that as a journalist, he was probably the first one to really grasp the importance of what was going on and to publicize it. And it's to his everlasting credit that he did so. I've had a number of listeners come up to me and thank me for doing that show, saying it really got them wise to something before it took place, helped them understand a phenomenon going on. But he's done far more than that in his illustrious career. Danny Schechter, the news dissector, has been a filmmaker, a journalist, a television producer, a blogger for four decades now, starting as the news dissector on radio in Boston, working at CNN and ABC, doing a series on public broadcasting. He's won just about every award in the book. Right now, he has a daily blog. You can locate it at mediachannel.org, where he serves as blogger-in-chief and editor. It is our great pleasure to welcome to Media Matters none other than Danny Schechter. Danny, hello.
Hey, thank you for having me back on. I didn't realize it's been that long, but it has.
I guess
time flies when you're having fun, huh?
Well, when you're busy, let's put it that way. And you've certainly been busy.
Yeah.
I want to start in where we left off 2 years ago, which was with your work on the subprime mortgage crisis and your work on the collapse of the banking system, which you anticipated 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And, you've been following this story ever since. What is your sense of how the Obama administration is handling the financial crisis and how the news media are handling the financial crisis right now?
Well, let me just back up just a little bit just to tell people, I did a film called In Debt We Trust, warning, of this crisis. It came out after I did a film on Iraq, Weapons of Mass Deception, WMD. I basically was looking for an issue that could potentially bring people together or across party lines, across generational lines. And I saw this debt issue, coming down the tracks, and about to derail. And, I kind of latched onto it, for which I was called in some of the media a doom and gloomer, exaggerating and alarmist and the like. Now, of course, we're all alarmed by what's happened to our economy. And, I was hardly, the first person to see it or the only person to see it, but I sort of went from a zero to a hero in the minds of some, for actually bringing this to public attention. And, I've continued to do so since my film In Debt We Trust. I've written a book called Plunder, investigating our economic calamity, which is, available at Amazon and other outlets. And basically, it's an analysis of what actually was happening in the lead up to it. The book came out a week before Lehman Brothers went down. So, I've been following this in detail on my blog every day and articles I write as well, and speeches I give and all the rest of it. So, I obviously feel like, it seemed to me part of the project of, if you will, radical or social change in America is what happens to working people? What happens to our economy and their rights? I grew up in a working class family. I went to the Industrial and Labor Relations School at Cornell. I went to the London School of Economics. You know, I've been sort of sensitized to all this. When I was at 2020, I did the first story on the SNL crisis in prime time, you know, showing what was happening there, you know, how all these banks went down and were used basically in this incredible scam that was taking place then and is taking place now. Now I'm making a film based on Plunder, called Plunder, which is really about looking at the financial crisis as a crime story, trying to see how basically there's been a gigantic theft here, you know, billions of people's homes and our livelihoods and all the rest of it, as our society goes through a process we call financialization. Power, you know, going from the political process and the publicly accountable process to the privately run credit and loan and debt complex, very much like the military-industrial complex, run by the banks, controlled by financial institutions, and basically going from a relatively maybe 6% of our economy to over 30 to 40% of our economy. And you know, and that's this transfer of wealth and power in the hands of these financial companies, and they were the ones that began to figure out ways to securitize mortgages, basically not just to take a house, but to then turn the house into a security, its mortgage, and then borrow against it, leverage it, as and sometimes up to 30%, and then create these structured finance securities, which they then sold all over the world, misrepresenting their value, and they were rated by ratings agencies as AAA ratings, et cetera, and so forth. And you know, the consequence was that people began to find out, you know, the emperor has no clothes. These asset-backed securities have no assets backing them, that a lot of the people who were taking out these mortgages were induced to do so with offers that were deceptive and fraudulent and the like. And, you know, now they're losing their homes, workers are losing their jobs, and, you know, we're on the verge of maybe losing our country here. And the Obama administration is stepping into the breach by basically trying to go to people inside the system who have had some experience in the Clinton years at managing, you know, boom and bust cycles and meltdowns, you know, Larry Summers and this guy Tim Geithner and you know, other advisors to try to manage the meltdown, if you will, to try to soften it and to try to stop the erosion of value in the banks. And they've done this with, you know, gigantic, you know, subsidies, $750 million in TARP funds and other programs and the like, with the Federal Reserve coming in with, you know, maybe up to $100 trillion. And, you know, meanwhile, there's been an exposure of maybe $12.7 trillion in derivative products, credit default swaps and the like that can implode. So even though they've been busy doling out money, so far the situation has not gotten any better. In the next week or so, if they don't postpone it again, we're going to get the result of these bank stress tests, which show that these banks in some cases are basically insolvent. And so they require more money. Citibank needs another $10 billion, and the others. So, you know, we have a situation which is hardly out of the woods. In fact, we may be deeper in the woods.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Danny Schechter, the news dissector, author of the new book, Plunder, on the financial crisis, which he has chronicled. And you can follow his work at mediachannel.org, where he blogs daily, and his voluminous work all over the place, going back decades now. Covering.
Oh, my God, what did I get myself into?
Well, you cover everything. I mean, I've been doing the research for the show. I'm just going through your blog, and you really have it is literally a blog that covers the world of politics and the world of media. You're really one of the great media watchers, and I think that's one of the stories here of your work on the financial crisis, and we're going to get to some other issues, too, in the program, but I do want to talk again, because one of the things that was striking about your voice 2 or 3 years ago, and when you made In Debt We Trust, Danny, was that, you know, you were sort of alone out there. I mean, it wasn't like you were part of a huge chorus of people saying this is a problem.
Well, and I still feel I'm alone, you know, in one sense. You know, this is not an issue that has riveted the progressive movement in America. It is not an issue that people have really responded to. On a laundry list of issues, it's there. People, you know, say the right words about it. But in terms of direct action, people are far more exercised by the discovery of torture by the, you know, Bush administration and its approval at the highest levels. They're more concerned maybe even about media concentration as an issue in the future of the Internet and, you know, a whole laundry list of social concerns. But the economic justice issues have not been issues that have galvanized a response. I was just on the radio this morning talking with Jesse Jackson about this, about the silence, you know, in the country over, you know, the basic transfer of wealth from the poorest Americans to the richest institutions, the foreclosures, you know, which are just now surging again, you know, to beyond 10 million homes. And, you know, very few people are making this their issue and their concern. I've been trying for some time now to try to encourage the idea of teach-ins on campuses like we did in the Vietnam War era, you know, to try to inform people about it. The issues are a little complicated, and you know, so people tend to tune out, and they're in denial about it. They think, well, this is about finance. I don't have any stocks or investments, so therefore it's not going to affect me. But it's a real social crisis now. It's not just about, you know, people on Wall Street. It's about people all over America, Main Street, you know, and every campus where students are, you know, getting hit by higher student loans, and they're being finding out that their credit card companies are not going to, you know, keep them on as customers, or they're cutting back their lines of credit and all the rest of it. The squeeze is on. It's affecting, you know, almost everybody. You know, American Express is now rated as sort of junk. They just cut me back, you know, and I've been a member since 1981, you know, in terms of what I can use my card for, what my limit is, and all the rest of it. And I think this is happening throughout the country. So it's getting, the squeeze is on everybody, and it's been very hard to get people to respond to this in a way that I think they should, because I think it's the central issue, really. I mean, it's affecting so many people.
Danny Schechter, the News Dissector, our guest today, Media Matters. The number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We welcome your calls. Danny, I do want to just clear up this matter of the media and talk about it a little bit more before we move on. I mean, my sense, and I'd like to hear your assessment, is that the press coverage pretty much missed this. Even the business press, the people who are supposedly following this beat closely, pretty much missed this altogether.
Isn't that an extraordinary? I mean, not just the business press, the economists in the country. Jamie Galbraith, a very good progressive economist, you know, said that only 3 to 8 maybe economists in the American Economic Association even saw this coming. Yeah, the media not only didn't see it coming, didn't investigate it, didn't warn us about it when it might have done some good, but they were actually complicit in it, which many people don't realize. After the dot-com boom busted and, you know, advertising and media began to dry up, suddenly money from dodgy lenders, credit card companies, almost $3 billion over 4 years, began to get pumped into media organizations. That's why you saw, you know, MasterCard, priceless ads on the Academy Awards and throughout you know, mass media, Internet sites and the like. And what this did, that dancing girl on the Yahoo, you know, selling mortgages and all of the scamming, you know, so they were actually marketing these products or promoting them. And in some cases, big newspapers, because a lot of their money comes from Sunday real estate sales, they were involved in getting some kickbacks in the sales of housing for the, you know, sales that go through newspapers. So, you know, you have an industry that was not only blind to it, but actually profiting from it. And I've written about this. I just had a piece in the British Journalism Review, okay? Mm-hmm. The British Journalism Review, which got picked up by the Financial Times and the Guardian, and, you know, but it's very hard to get this into the American, you know, this critique into the American media. There has been some of it. I don't want to say there hasn't been. The Columbia Journalism Review has been covering Dean Starkman over there has been doing a good job. Dean Baker has been doing a good job. There, you know, there are people who have been monitoring the financial press and writing about it, but it hasn't really worked its way into any kind of campaigning, you know, by activists. You know, it's sort of an issue that seems to be technical and, you know, kind of a subspecies of a media complaint, when actually it's very central to the whole economy. What I find is that there is great information on various blogs that I've been reading. I just was reading about the Chrysler bailout with a lot of concerns being raised that, you know, I just haven't seen in the major media at all. What's happening there. I mean, this is reshaping our whole society. We're talking about 47,000 more workers who work for GM about to be, quote, according to the New York Times today, trimmed. I love that word. They're going to be trimmed, okay? So you have tens of thousands of people, communities in the Midwest, particularly hard hit by all of this as the auto supply chain, you know, begins to get devastated by, you know, Chrysler and GM go down. And, you know, who do we hear talking about it? I mean, we just had in Congress last week the Mortgage Brokers Association declare a victory in the Senate over a measure to help homeowners. And a group of Democrats, people we call Dino, Democrats in name only, you know, who voted with the mortgage bankers, you know, against the homeowners of America and against the people in deep need. And these are Democrats. So, you know, this has been a bipartisan problem going back, you know, to the Clintonites and their whole approach, the suspension of the Glass-Steagall Act. All of this was done on, you know, that was done on the Democrats' watch.
Our guest today, Danny Schechter, and the amendment you were referring to is sponsored by Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. I just want to make that clear for folks. And you write about that on your blog.
Yeah, I mean, Durbin says the banks own the place.
Yeah,
what he's talking about, the United States Senate.
Yeah, it's quite a striking statement by Senator Durbin. Indeed, it was.
You know, really a candid admission, and this is the whole problem. So when we look at things, you know, we tend to look at labels. We say, well, these people, you know, are in senators, they're in office, they're in power, but they're in office, but they're not in power, because power is actually the lobbyists and the big special interests who basically can call the shots on key votes. That's what happened with the bankruptcy reform bill. Joe Biden was for it, you know, making it harder to use the bankruptcy laws.
Our guest, Danny Schechter. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Danny Schechter is the news dissector, blogger, author, filmmaker, author of the new book, Plunder. He's done a lot of the pace-setting work on the subprime mortgage crisis and the financial crisis. He still covers that story, but he covers the whole world of media and politics, so he's fair game for any
today
question or comment
World Press
you might
Freedom
have.
Day, isn't it, Bob?
Pardon, Danny?
I think today is World Press Freedom Day.
It is indeed. I was going to ask you about that, but let's go to the phone lines first, because we have a couple callers waiting quite patiently. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Danny Schechter, the news dissector.
I'd like to know, if the banks are as hard off as the media says they are, why do I pass three new buildings going up, built by banks, on my three-mile drive to work in beautiful downtown Urbana?
Well, a lot of those, you know, investments in those buildings were made before this whole crisis hit, you know, when we were all in this sort of area of heady euphoria and enthusiasm, where these guys, you know, couldn't see it coming and didn't want to see it coming, even though it was obvious to a lot of people that it was. So they were committing to building and expanding, you know, their institutions. There's a lot of shrinkage going on. A lot of banks are imploding. The FDIC is taking over. You know, a lot of banks, and unless you follow it, it's, you know, it's sort of little items in the newspaper. You don't get the big picture of all the banks that have already collapsed, and I think more will.
Okay, let's go now to line two. Urbana, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Hi. Earlier you mentioned the statement by Senator Durbin about the banks owning the Congress, or the industry owning the Congress, and I recall that many years ago, Will Rogers said that we have the best Congress that money can buy. And I'm wondering what you see as the differences between now and then.
Well, I didn't quibble with Will then, and I won't quibble with him.
No, you don't remember Will Rogers, Danny. We're not going to date you that far.
Of course. I remember him. He wasn't my contemporary. But, yeah, I mean, clearly, we are interested in issues mostly. We don't really look too closely at interests. There's often a difference between the two. Interests frame issues, okay? And in this case, the banking industry has been on a very good job with its philanthropy and with its, you know, kind of stealth way of operating for most people not to look too hard at how they work. I mean, we need banks. We have checking accounts. We use ATM machines. You know, everything is structured for our convenience. You know, we've been a credit card culture for a long time with the mall being more important in a way than the factory in our view of how the economy works. So it's only now that we're beginning to realize that a lot of these banks took on obligations, loaned money, were involved in deals that were extremely shaky, were not regulated, if they were regulated, they were regulated by, you know, Bush-era regulators who didn't ask too many questions. And, you know, the consequence of all of this is that the house of cards is kind of collapsing. What I'm looking at, you know, frankly, is not just the mistakes that were made. This is how it's usually portrayed in the media. You know, they made certain mistakes. They miscalculated. They didn't have good risk management systems. And therefore, you know, we're in the situation that we're in. I'm looking at, and I'm making a film about this now, if I can find the money to finish it, is, you know, the financial crisis as a crime story. Because I think really there was a lot of criminal activity here. You know, I mean, we have a long history of corporate crime going back to the Great Depression. You know, after the 1929 crash, there was something called the Pecora Commission, which was a government commission that actually looked into the causes of the crash, indicting a lot of corporate larceny, you know, and speculation and what have you. And we need something like that today to a real investigation, which you'll notice we have yet to have about why this happened. But, you know, Bernie Madoff, let's, you know, give him credit for actually revealing the existence of the Ponzi scheme, because he was not alone. And there is, I think, a lot more crime that's going to be coming out. The FBI is indicting a lot of people in the mortgage industry who scammed, you know, people, vulnerable people, particularly minorities in the what I call the subprime housing boom. And I think we're going to see more of that. So there's a mix here of, you know, of institutions that were blind, but also institutions that were very cunning and shrewd and were covering their behinds, if you will, with these various credit default swaps. You know, in other words, they would give Bob McChesney a loan, okay? And they would figure, mm-hmm. Well, Bob McChesney's just a professor, and even though he's made a fortune on his many books and his lectures and all the rest of it,
yeah,
nevertheless, he may not be able to pay off his obligation. So we're going to also take out an insurance policy as a third party against Bob McChesney. We're going to bet that he's going to fail. So we're covered no matter what happens. If he succeeds or if he fails, we've been successful through our hedge funds and this and that. We've hedged our bets. And this is what this whole system has been about. So, you know, even to this day, I mean, we're seeing, for example, the people who own creditors at Chrysler are being offered 35% on the dollar. The people who were involved as counterparties in AIG are being offered 100% on the dollar. So even now, there's a real discrimination in a blue-collar industry and what's happening on Wall Street.
Our guest, Danny Schechter. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Coming to you live today, Sunday, May 3rd. 2009. Let's go back to the phone lines again to line 3, Champagne. You're on the air with Danny Schechter, the news dissector.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question that will be kind of a follow-up to what you just answered. And I'm not an economist. I'm actually a biological scientist, and I've been reading about this, and I agree with you that this is criminal what has been done. The question is, since this, well, bets, they call them insurance, this insurance to, you know, these credit default swaps, could they have just, instead of dumping so much money to the banks, just paid back the premiums that people paid and said, this was ill-conceived, pull it down, here's your, what you paid, that's the end of it. You get nothing. You don't get any benefit to the money you put in.
Well, you know, unfortunately, what we're seeing now is that the people who were engaging in this behavior, in these scams and these manipulations and maneuvers, are being rewarded. You know, there is a rule in finance supposedly called moral hazard, that somebody shouldn't be allowed to profit on illegal, you know, decisions and the like. But what we're seeing now with the TARP money, this is the government money that's going into banks and all the rest of it, is that it's going in with no conditions, basically. The people who are actually a part of this whole scam are, you know, being rewarded for it. You know, in our government, a lot of people, you know, often are very skeptical of conspiracy theories, okay? But the U.S. government, under laws called the RICO laws, actually believes that there are conspiracies in the real world, and they prosecute. Under the RICO Act, people who act together to further a criminal enterprise. I mean, like, for example, the mafia gets prosecuted. If you're a mafia soldier, you know, kind of down at the bottom on the street level, and you're a mafia boss, you can both be indicted under these RICO laws, and that's how they put a lot of mafia people away. But these laws are not being used to prosecute Wall Street right now. And, you know, this is the question. This is why there's so much anger in the country. That's why, you know, Obama said to the bankers, he said, "I'm the only one standing between you and the pitchforks," by which he meant, you know, the angry people who want, you know, to jail, if not do worse to some of these people. I mean, a lot of people are referencing, you know, the lovely Marie Antoinette, you know, and the guillotine. You know, they're feeling like these people should be made to pay for what they did. And I think that we are, you know, in an era where there's going to be a lot more, you know, I don't know if you know the movie that won the Academy Award, There Will Be Blood. I think there is going to be an upsurge of class-based anger. And, you know, a lot of it up until now has been sort of turned, workers turning it on themselves and their families, and these shooting incidents where people are being wiped out and whole families, you know, frustration. A lot of them were workers or people deeply in debt or people who had lost their jobs and all the rest of it, you know, because there's a lot of stigma about this. But, you know, as people begin to find out who the real enemy, so to speak, is here, who's really responsible, I think we're going to see a lot of antagonism. I mean, this is a history in our country. If anybody has ever looked at the history of labor in America and the wars that took place for people to unionize and to get, you know, justice, I mean, I think that we could be in for, you know, some pretty bloodied times ahead here, unless somebody jumps into the, you know, arena here and starts organizing around these issues.
Danny Schechter, the question I have when you make this point about the antagonism that's coming forth and the anger of the many Americans against the injustice of these banks not having to pay a price for, you know, wrecking the economy and making off with trillions of dollars. The problem, I mean, what the question I have and what I wonder is, you know, the Obama administration has, with Geithner and Larry Summers, has pretty much followed the policies of Paulson and Bernanke. And Bernanke, obviously, is still at the Fed. But it has been we don't want to nationalize the banks. We're basically do everything in our power to resuscitate the system by giving the bankers all everything they want. And the Republicans are certainly not hostile to the banks. It may be a little bit of rhetoric, but on the voting floor, they're with them all the way.
Yeah,
where does this anger going to channel itself through? Is there the political system doesn't seem to have an option for the people?
Well, you notice that the Hannitys of the world on Fox News and, you know, they've been organizing against the government. They've been portraying Obama as this socialist dictator who's trying to impose socialism in America, okay, completely concocted, you know, argument, but it seems to resonate with people, in part because our media system doesn't really educate people about this in any kind of thorough way. I mean, it may be mentioned or cited here and there, but it's not really explained very clearly. I mean, the difference between a 36% tax rate and a 39% tax rate is not socialist revolution, you know, and that's how it's being portrayed. And of course, there's the unions are being treated a lot differently than the bankers. You know, the UAW membership has approved contract modifications that give Chrysler pretty much everything Chrysler wanted in terms of work rule changes. The workforce took a big pay cut. The retirees' medical care was also a hit, too. You know, the union basically, in order to survive, has basically given up a lot of the things that it's gained over the years. Now it may get 55% of Chrysler, but it may be a company worth nothing, because the company, it's reported this afternoon that they're talking about selling off its assets. So they may end up with nothing, you know, in the end here if Chrysler is totally diluted and sold off. So, you know, we're in a situation here where you have to look a lot deeper than just at the surface of these stories to find out what's really going on here. I mean, it's complicated. I mean, for example, again, with Chrysler, Obama criticized the hedge funds for holding out and not going along with the deal that the government wanted. But it wasn't just hedge funds. There was also some pension funds in there who were trying to represent their own members and try to get the best deal they could for them. So, you know, you have a situation here where there's a conflict going on many different levels between different interests, the workers, the bondholders, the shareholders, the company managements, and the like. And, of course, the car owners, you know, and they shut down, as they plan to do, all the Chrysler plants and dealerships this summer. You know, if you do have a problem with your windshield, where are you going to go? You know, I mean, to get your warranty honored, there'll probably be nowhere to go. So a lot of people are going to be screwed even more here.
Our guest, Danny Schechter. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580. We have several callers who have been waiting patiently. I promise I'll get to you all, so let's go right back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Farina, Illinois. You're on the air with Danny Schechter, the news dissector.
Hi. Thanks again for a great show, Professor. And it's an honor to talk to Mr. Schechter. I think I'd like you to talk a little about the just maybe a short history of the SNL crimes, and was anybody actually prosecuted beyond just a two or three handful?
Well, you know, that's what happens is, you know, there was the Keating Five, if you remember, this group of owners of SNLs, and, you know, in California, one of them was the big buddy of John McCain, and McCain was implicated in that whole crisis, which was sort of came out a little bit in the campaign this past year, but not very much, because, you know, basically our media promotes amnesia, you know what I mean? Anything that's not breaking news or happening in the minute now, right now, you know, people tend to forget, or the context of things they tend to forget, because it's never really explained. So, you know, here you had also people in these banks investing in real estate deals. You know, these were local saving and loan institutions, but the savings were being turned into investments, you know, in the Southwest, in Arizona particularly, where they were building all these housing tracts and all the rest of it, and the whole system collapsed. And it was a big mess, and it was cleaned up by the government stepping in with a reconstruction finance, entity, which basically bailed out a lot of these people. A lot of people paid fines and didn't go to jail. In fact, with a lot of these criminal cases under the Bush Justice Department, people who were committing criminal acts were allowed to plead and pay fines rather than do time. And, you know, this is, you know, partly what Bernie Madoff's lawyers was hoping to try to do. But there was so much anger in this case, and it was rather large, $65 billion Ponzi scheme. You know, Bernie, you know, has gone to jail. But you know, Americans love super criminals. I don't know if you knew this, Bob, but Al Capone started his career as an accountant.
No, I did not know that.
So, you know, there's a long tradition here of various things, and the way the laws are written, you know, the burden of proof, you have to prove intent with some of these corporate crimes, white-collar crimes. So, you know, people say, well, look, we didn't intend to do this. This just happened by accident, you know, et cetera, and so forth. So the burden of proof is much higher, you know, on the guy that, you know, steals the million than the guy, you know, that steals the iPod.
You know, Danny, I've got a couple of callers that I want to get to in a second, but there's one question I do want to ask you, because on your website you note that tomorrow is the 39th anniversary since the four students were shot at the anti-war demonstration at Kent State University, which triggered enormous demonstrations and riots in the United States. And you were right in the middle of everything in the politics of that period. You cut your teeth then, you came of age and were an anti-war leader and activist. And you're describing now a period we're going into that's going to be one of tremendous upheaval, too. Do you think we're going to be in a period like the 60s? Do you think there's going to be a lot of parallels there? Or do you think it's a different type of zone we're heading into?
You know, part of the genius of the Bush war effort was not to have the draft, okay? Not to create, you know, go for a volunteer military, which then, in a sense, had no rights to do anything, and we didn't have the complaint that they were unfairly drafted or targeted. So, you know, that exacerbated the situation in the 60s, you know, the draft, you know, kind of, which was used in the Vietnam War. But, you know, 2 points here. First, I think it's really important for us to learn our history and to honor the people who have gone before. I also, in my blog today, it's up on mediachannel.org, you know, I talk about the Haymarket massacre that took place in Chicago, people protesting in that era, and the people in China who on May 4th, 1919, fought against, you know, kind of a decision by international courts to basically, you know, undermine China's sovereignty. It was one of the first, you know, big patriotic movements, you know, in China on May 4th. So I think we don't remember. Our sense of memory and of our history is really important. I mean, you've done some brilliant work on media history and the way the media system was organized. And most people don't know this stuff. They don't know about, you know, the way the laws were, how the corporations managed to get around the principles of, you know, that were trying to create more fairness in our media system. So, yeah, I mean, I sense that this is cyclical, just as the economy is cyclical. And I think that as students begin to realize how exposed they are, how much they've become serfs, if you will, and, you know, imprisoned by debt, I think there's going to be, with the right spark, there's going to be protests against this. I mean, one of the things Jesse Jackson was talking about this morning is saying, look, the banks can now get money at 0 to 1% loans, okay? Why can't students get loans at that level rather than pay the high rates that they're paying for student loans right now? So I think that there needs to be, you know, a realization by people who don't see themselves as workers. They don't see themselves as oppressed in any way. You know, they're just going to school. Realize that they, too, are being ripped off and exploited. And I think when they begin to see that, I think that we're going to see more people standing up against it. And I think, you know, I mean, there are so many issues. There are so many things that are, you know, injustices and wrongs in the society. But I think, you know, partly it's a function of class that the issues that the left, I don't know how left it is, but, you know, the progressives have raised have not been the mass economic issues by and large. They don't sort of, you know, they've come out of universities. They don't really have that sort of working class or, you know, understanding maybe. And I think that is something that's important to recognize. And, you know, when you have, you know, the Bush administration and terrible war and, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan and all the rest of it, it's no wonder that people turned to Obama because he was promising hope and change and all the rest of it, which we desperately need. Now, as Obama, in a sense, begins to disappoint in some ways, I think some of the people who learned how to use social networking and organizing to promote Obama may now turn some of those tools, if not against Obama, then to press the Obama administration to live up to its promises. I've just made a new film, Bob, called People's President. It's coming out in video from choices.net. Mm-hmm. And it's about the grassroots campaign of the Obama election, you know, campaign. I wanted to find out how is it that a guy that starts off with 10% recognition could win? And I think it's because of the strategy that he used, grassroots strategy. So my film is about the grassroots organizing, the internet organizing that was done on his behalf and the way he managed to bring in a generational shift in his support base. And I think that's what put him over the top. And I think we've got to learn those lessons. So I looked at the campaign not as a political pundit, but as an organizer. How did they do it? And what can we learn from it? And so it's People's Presidents, a new DVD that's coming out that people might find interesting. I'd like to get it screened there in Champlain, you know, Urbana, and get some reaction from people there. Because, I think it's a, you know, something that's happening right now, how Obama was able very smartly to organize his own media operation. So while he was on major media, he was also not caught up in the cable news, you know, madness, which was not his principal thing, you know, debating with the pundits every night. It was he created his own communication system using the internet and social networking.
Our guest is Danny Schechter. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. If you go to mediachannel.org, where Danny is the blogger in chief and where he is the editor, you can read his blog. You can get links to and find out about his films, his books, his new book, Plunder, and all the other work that Danny Schechter is up to. We have a couple of people who have been waiting very patiently. Let's get right back to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Danny Schechter, the news dissector.
Partly spoke to what I'd like to comment about, and is the fact that I'm one of those persons who is extremely disappointed to date with the Obama administration. Really, just from the day after the election, he started looking, to my mind, he looks like Clinton version 2.0, which was not a compliment by any means, because as far as I was concerned, Clinton was Reagan, Reagan light, you know, Reagan 1. Whatever, and I mean, he's looking very conservative, right? You know, even right down to his dress, which I'm being a little nitpicking here, but he's wearing the same dark blue suits with a plain shirt and a plain tie and all that stuff. He looks like, you know, the way Bush would dress or Danny Hastert would dress and so on and so forth. And it's as far as I can see to date so far, he just really just looks to me like a rather wealthy person from Hyde Park, Illinois, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant with brown skin and values to match.
Think of it in structural terms. You know, our political system as a plane, you know, with two wings. You know, it has the Republican wing and it has the Democratic wing. In order to get into, you know, the presidency, you know, you're dealing with tremendous number of power brokers and special interests, and you know, and a lot of people on Wall Street supported Obama because they, you know, they believe that confidence in the system is very important in order to keep it going. And Bush has sort of blown it. You know, he became, you know, a target of derision. You know, the Republicans had nothing really to offer. There was a whole new generation politically that had to be appealed to, and so Obama, you know, was a kind of modernizer, you know, young, attractive, hip, engaging, smart, you know, Harvard. What can I tell you? I mean, I went to Harvard. I sort of met people like this, you know, I think you do a disservice if you just think of this in personality terms. You know, we all tend to think like the president has all this power, you know, but the president is also in a political system of, if not checks and balances, no, maybe balances, not checks, you know, and he has to get on board a lot of different interests. And so he made a calculation in order to deal with the economy. He talks about it in the New York Times Magazine today about his economic choices, why he went to Summers and Geithner, why he felt he needed people who were, because he had to hit the road running, you know what I mean? And if that phone rings at 3 a.m, you know, he has to be, you know, on top of it. So, you know, he went to experienced people. And of course, that means that you trade. You trade. That's what politics is. It's the art of compromise. He had been in the Senate. The man was pretty experienced about the legislative process. He knows how things works. And so he tried to co-opt the military, co-opt the sort of centrist Republicans, and bring them onto his side and try to isolate the right. And he's done a pretty good job of that, in the sense that even though they're very noisy, they themselves don't, you know, have lost a lot of respect and their base. They only have maybe 26%. He's been managing to stay high in the political, you know, in the polls and all the rest of it, their personal approval rating. So don't confuse him with the way this whole process operates. I think that we have to sort of look at this and how it unfolds and see if we're concerned about it, how can we affect it? How can we change it? How can we put other input into the whole process here? And that's what's missing in my mind. You know,
Danny, this point came up earlier in the program. Last week on the show, we had Kevin Phillips, the political author and strategist. And in his new book that we were talking about, Bad Money, that's right, you know, he makes a fairly strong argument with evidence that finance capital, really the bad guys you write about, have more or less moved into the Democratic Party. I mean, they already own the Republican Party, but they've also now owned the Democratic Party. And when you read his book or listen to him talk, you know, it seems like the idea that any president of the United States is a Democrat would be taking the sort of measures that Joseph Stiglitz or Paul Krugman recommend seriously would be extraordinarily difficult. I mean, all the pressure would go in the direction Obama has gone.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's a term that's used by people in finance that's interesting. It's called capture. In other words, it's like the hunter captures the game or the game captures the hunter. And in this case, financial interests, have captured the government in many cases, and they've set out to do it over years. They spent $5 billion in lobbying to get their, you know, deregulation measures in place and all the rest of it. So they've been working at this. You know, some people try to capture political office because they think that's really where power is. These guys see real power as being their ability to influence the agenda. There's a website for people who might find it interesting to want to know more about this by a guy who used to be Simon Johnson, who used to be at the International Monetary Fund. It's called baselinescenario.com, baselinescenario.com. And, you know, I think you'll find very interesting his assessment of not only what happened to the global economy, but what we can do about it. I mean, he's a kind of an activist and a great analyst, and he explains and runs all this stuff down with great precision, so you might want to check him out.
Our guest, Danny Schechter, you're listening to Media Matters. We've got about 7 minutes left. We have two callers waiting patiently. I want to get to both of them so they can.
How am I doing, Bob? Am I all right?
I'll give you
here under these tough questions.
I know you. I can feel your sweat through the lines, through the ether. Well, let's go now to line two, Champaign, Illinois. You're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Yeah, thank you. Moving back to criminal activity on the part of the banks, I for a long time have believed that one of their profit centers is laundering drug money for the cartels, and I just wonder if you've looked into that. I don't see any way that these banks could be moving, you know, literally hundreds of billions of dollars without having some kind of clue of where it's coming from. And, is anybody taking this very seriously? I'm sure that there are buying off people to make sure that the government doesn't take care of that, but I'm wondering if you've looked into it.
I haven't myself, but I'm certainly interested in it. I mean, one of the big areas here, and this is kind of the president of France, Sarkozy, raised this at the G20 meeting. You know, they were trying to get tougher regulation. Obama wanted more economic stimulus, and he didn't get it. But, you know, the people who are favoring, you know, more regulation were talking about offshore oil, you know, offshore finance. You know, we mostly talk about offshore oil, you know, but offshore finance. If we want to do something to save the American economy, maybe instead of invading Afghanistan again, we should invade the Cayman Islands, okay? There's an interesting IMF report on this baselinescenario.com that I was talking about called Ponzi Schemes of the Caribbean. It's a technical paper by the IMF talking about how all these kind of maneuvers are done, you know, and I think the whole idea of drug money is you want to try to, you know, as much as possible launder it by putting it into legitimate enterprise. I mean, this is what the mafia did over the years. You know, they went from, illegal money. Suddenly there was Las Vegas. That was a great place to launder it, et cetera, and so forth. So I'm actually very interested in any more information on it. I'll just give you my email. If you come up with anything you'd like to share with me, it's dissector@mediachannel.org. If anybody wants to write to me or, send me any information of things that they find particularly interesting. I mean, in a way, we're reduced because we don't have big media enterprises behind us. We don't have a lot of money to fund the kinds of investigations that are needed. We have to collaborate with each other and work together to the degree that we can. I've been advocating a People's PCORA commission, you know, that we have around the same way that there were the war crimes tribunals that Bertrand Russell did during the 60s, you know, on the war in Vietnam. We need to popularize and publicize and investigate what's happening and make people more aware of it. And this is something which I think is something that universities could be doing very, with teach-ins and the like,
and then get those teachings on C-SPAN or get them on YouTube and all the rest of it and get the word out.
Danny Schefter, let's go to our final caller now before we wrap up today. Let's go to line four, Chicago. You're on the air with the News Dissector.
Talk about having input. About 10 years ago, when I first heard the term derivatives, only to discover that there were, at that time, about $150 trillion outstanding in investments in that area, let alone the sudden surfacing of hedge funds. I had called in a national public radio here in Chicago and brought it up and to a group of economists around the show at that time. And the attorneys were kind of, what are derivatives, you know? So we drew a blank in terms of that. But to my consternation, the only reason I learned of it was of some literature that that bygone candidate for the presidency, LaRouche, was handing out. And he pointed out that all that evidence is going to tumble down like a house of cards. And even to the point of where derivatives and other things were mentioned as a no-no for investment by banks and so forth, by who else but Greenspan, the maestro, and only to learn later on that he relinquished his views on derivatives to the banks, but as a result of the influence of, obviously, the financial lobbyists and so forth. So here I called in, and then she, Gretchen Helper, who was a host of the show, mentioned that, followed up with an author who wrote a book on derivatives, and continually the public is so lacking in the knowledge of this.
We don't have financial literacy taught in those schools, even at the most basic levels, how to manage money, what's compounded interest. You know, basic things that people should know is not really being taught. You know, so it's not surprising. As long as we're illiterate on these subjects, we can more easily be manipulated. I mean, the LaRouche people, who I don't support politically in any way, nevertheless have published some interesting articles about some of this stuff and about the PCORA Commission that, you know, I respect.
Well, Danny, let me ask you one thing. We only have a minute or two left, but I mean, this is a show called Media Matters, and you're a journalist, and we're talking about the press coverage. You've already talked about The Economist, who, as James Galbraith, who was once a guest in the show, talked about then, too, is who completely missed the financial crisis for the most part. And the news media completely missed it. In fact, they, as you pointed out, if anything, poured gasoline on the flames, if more than anything. You know, John Stewart had the famous run-in with Jim Cramer last month or 2 months ago on CNBC about how he was touting the economy while it was collapsing. Have any heads rolled in mainstream journalism? Is anyone ever accountable for, like, blowing it, or any economists no longer allowed to be pundits because they were so wrong 5 years ago?
I mean, you know, maybe it's a sign of with the lack of serious, the way in which news has become entertainment or financetainment, you know, on CNBC, where I also did a brief stint, you know, that, you know, that nobody's held accountable, you know, for any of this stuff. Oh, I was just wrong, but I'll be right on the next call that I'm going to be making. So, you know, we have no real, you know, people who are monitoring this. It's interesting that it takes a comedy show to expose these practices. And I think, you know, Jon Stewart deserves a lot of credit, but he's not the only one writing. I was surprised, by the way, when the Financial Times in London, their editor wrote about this and put me in the same paragraph with Jon Stewart. Thank you, Financial Times. But, you know, of course, I don't have the same audience and or access to the audience. And, you know, this is one of the problems. I mean, we need more collaboration among media activists, in my opinion, to promote each other's work in this area and bring it to a larger audience. And this seems to be missing also, you know. And so the idea is somehow if you're the only people that you can, you know, learn from in this area are experts, and the experts themselves often don't know what they're talking about. So,
Danny, yeah. I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to get me out of the studio for the next program. Let me just real quickly let our listeners know our guest today has been Danny Schefter from MediaChannel.org. Go to MediaChannel.org. You can see his blog. You can find out about his new book, Plunder, about his forthcoming documentary. And be in touch with him at dissector@mediachannel.org if you want to email Danny Schefter. Danny, again, thank you so much
for taking
the time.
Thank you, Bob. I'm still a great fan of your work, and thank you for having me on.
My pleasure to have you, Danny. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board today, Andrew Boyle, my producer, and everyone have a great week. See you in 167 hours with Barbara Ehrenreich. Bye-bye.